We are showing that God is faithful to His Word. He doesn't forget any part of it. That ought to convince you that if you found a part to which you can attach your life, He isn't forgetting that one either. You can count on it. We've been studying the so-called lost tribes of Israel. We're not British Israelites. I tell you that repeatedly to keep some shallow-minded person from finding another box to put me in. We are simply showing you that God never lost them. The facts that underlie the interpretations of the British Israelism cult have failed to let everybody know when they left fact and started speculating. I don't even quarrel with their speculations as long as that distinction is made. Don't throw the baby out of the bathwater. There is no influential body of bent proof that didn't start with a solid limb that they bent. And they're right in recognizing that God's got two houses to deal with. Ezekiel points that out. And that the house of Judah and the house of Israel became recipients of God's promise. And if He isn't faithful to His promises, then His faithfulness fails. And He gave promises to Judah as a tribal nation. He gave promises to Judah, the family line. He focused those promises in David, one of the descendants of Judah. He gave promises to the house of Israel, and not one of His promises shall fail. Now, no matter how interesting what we do may be to anybody, I fail my purpose if I don't get across the basic concept, God's faithful. Now, once in a while, to let you know that there are many units to this puzzle and this detective trip we're taking through history to find the tracings of God's people so that, as usual, we can get on the corner after He already got there. I brought us in focus with the Khazars the other night. This is the Khazar Jewish kingdom that existed between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea in southern Russia. Now today, for example, the Jews of our times fall into two main divisions. Sephardim, Ashkenazim, and an understanding of the Khazar Jews will help you understand this distinction. The Sephardim are descendants of the Jews who since antiquity had lived in Spain, Sephard, in the Hebrew, until they were expelled at the end of the 15th century and settled in the countries bordering on the Mediterranean, the Balkans, and to a lesser extent in Western Europe. They spoke a Spanish-Hebrew dialect, Ladino, preserved their own traditions and religious rites, and in the 1960s, the number of Sephardim was estimated at 500,000 worldwide. The Ashkenazim at the same period numbered about 11 million. This writer concludes, in common parlance, Jew is practically synonymous with Ashkenazi Jew. The term's misleading, for the Hebrew word Ashkenaz was in medieval rabbinical literature applied to Germany, thus contributing to the legend that modern Jewry originated on the Rhine. There is, however, no other term to refer to the non-Sephardic majority of contemporary Jewry. Now, there are some who will say that the Ashkenazim are limited to the descendants of the Khazars. They're not. It's more of an all-inclusive term for those that are not Sephardim. For the sake of piquantry, it should be mentioned that the Ashkenaz of the Bible refers to a people living somewhere in the vicinity of Mount Ararat and Armenia. The name occurs in Genesis 10, 3 and 1 Chronicles 1, 6, as one of the sons of Gomer, who was a son of Japheth, Ashkenaz is also a brother of Togarma, and a nephew of Magog, whom the Khazars, according to King Joseph, claimed as their ancestor. Now, I left you on these Khazarites with an account of the great Sephardim scholar who was an attendant in the court of the Caliph in Spain. According to his own account, Hasdai first heard of the existence of an independent Jewish kingdom from some merchant traders from Khorasan in Persia. He doubted the truth of their story. Later, he questioned the members of a Byzantine diplomatic mission to Cordoba. I read this the other night, but I'm going to go past it tonight. And they confirmed the merchant's account, contributing a considerable amount of factual detail about the Khazar kingdom, including the name Joseph of its present king. Thereupon, Hasdai decided to send couriers with a letter to King Joseph. The letter contains a list of questions about the Khazar state, its people, method of government, armed forces, and so on, including an inquiry to which of the 12 tribes Joseph belonged. This seemed to indicate that Hasdai thought the Jewish Khazars to hail from Palestine, as the Spanish Jews did, and perhaps even to represent one of the lost tribes. Joseph replied. I'm going to skip over some of the reply that tells of their conversion, how they came to be converted as Jews. And go right to the letters that are called the Khazar correspondence between Hasdai and the king of the Khazars, Joseph. To take Hasdai's letter first, it starts with a Hebrew poem. Now, this is that Spanish Jew, truly a Jew from the kingdom of Judah, under the Arab reign of the Mediterranean in Spain. It starts with a Hebrew poem in the then fashionable manner of a rhapsodic verse poem which contains hidden allusions or riddles and frequently acrostics. The poem exalts the military victories of the addressee, King Joseph. At the same time, the initial letters of the lines form an acrostic which spells out the full name of Hasdai bar Isaac bar Ezra bar Shaphut, followed by the name of Menahem ben Sharuk. Now, this Menahem was a celebrated Hebrew poet, lexicographer, and grammarian, a secretary and protege of Hasdai's. He was given the task of drafting the epistle to King Joseph in his most ornate style, and he took the opportunity to immortalize himself by inserting his own name into the acrostic after that of his patron. After the poem, the compliments and diplomatic flourishes, the letter gives a glowing account of the prosperity of Moorish Spain, the happy condition of the Jews under its caliph, the like of which has never been known. And thus the derelict sheep were taken into care, the arms of their persecutors paralyzed, and the yoke was discarded. The letter goes on to say, the country we live in is called Hebrew Sepharad, but the Ishmaelites who inhabit it call it Al-Andalus. Hasdai then proceeds to explain how he first heard about the existence of the Jewish kingdom from the merchants of Khorasan. Then in more detail from the Byzantine envoys, and he reports what these envoys told him. I questioned them, the Byzantines, about it, and they replied that it was true, that the name of the kingdom is Al-Khazar. Between Constantinople and this country, there's a journey of 15 days by sea. But they said, by land, there are many other people between us and them. The name of the ruling king is Joseph. Ships come to us from their land, bringing fish, furs, and all sorts of merchandise. They are in alliance with us and honored by us. We exchange embassies and gifts. They are powerful and have a fortress for their outposts and troops which go out on forays from time to time. Then Hasdai relates his earlier efforts to get in touch with Joseph. Having thus described in detail how his letter came to be written, and his efforts to have it delivered, Hasdai proceeds to ask a series of direct questions, which reflect his avidity for more information about every aspect of the Khazar land, from its geography to its rights in observing the Sabbath. The concluding passage in Hasdai's letter strikes a note quite different from that of its opening paragraphs. Quote, having spoken of the kindness of the caliph, now he seems to contradict, which is that tension in the displaced Jewish frame. I feel urged to know the truth, whether there is really a place on this earth where harassed Israel can rule itself, where it is subject to nobody. If I were to know that this is indeed the case, I would not hesitate to forsake all honors, to resign my high office, to abandon my family, and to travel over mountains and plains, over land and water, until I arrive at the place where my Lord, the Jewish king, rules. And I also have one request, to be informed whether you have any knowledge of the possible date of the final miracle, the coming of the Messiah, which, wandering from country to country, we are awaiting. Dishonored and humiliated in our dispersion, we have to listen in silence to those who say, every nation has its own land, and you alone possess not even a shadow of a country on this earth. Now, you want to know what Joseph replied? Huh? Later. Sing up. Now, I want to leave those Khazarites for a while. You'll remember I left them there, right? I want you to go to Genesis 46. Just hang on a minute. I stand up and preach for an hour and a half every Sunday. You can stand there for a while. Go to Genesis 46. Got your Bible? We have already commented that when the children of Israel, the promises were given to Noah, he then blessed two of his sons. Shem would receive a blessing that would bless all other nations. Japheth was to dwell in the tents of Shem, and Ham was cursed. Out of Shem comes, through Eber, Abram. Then to Abram is given the blessing through Sarah that is listed in all the records of Abraham's blessing, passed on through Isaac, passed from Isaac through Jacob, not Esau, and from Jacob it is divided, Reuben losing the right of primogeniture, which is firstborn by his sins, and the blessings of Abraham through Isaac and Jacob are divided, to Judah going the scepter and lawgiver, to Joseph the birthright. Now, what's a Jew? None of these. There's not a Jew in the camp yet. Judah and the citizens of his kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, are the first Jews. And dwelling in the kingdom of Judah are the descendants of Levi, Benjamin, and Judah. All of them qualify as the citizens of the kingdom, plus various ones of the 10-tribe kingdom to the north, Ephraim, Joseph, Samaria, who matriculated down. The Jews became citizens of that southern kingdom and are first called that in the Bible, and the 10 tribes that split to the north were not called Jews. They lived together down in Egypt. They lived together when they went out of bondage, even though Jacob had divided the blessing. They lived together in the promised land under Joshua until the king Saul was appointed, followed by David, who united the kingdom. followed by Solomon, who built the temple in a united kingdom, then sinned, had the kingdom wrested from him, and in the time of his son Rehoboam, the kingdom split with the two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, forming the kingdom of Judah, Levi staying with them because the temple was in Jerusalem, which was in the kingdom of Judah, and the 10 tribes of the north split off, alternately being called the kingdom of Israel or Ephraim, as Judah became the head and thus the name of the southern kingdom. Joseph's son Ephraim, given the primary blessing, becomes synonymous with the name kingdom of Israel, because the promise was this Ephraim kingdom would bear his name, or Ephraim. Under the king Omri, the capital was placed in Samaria, and thereafter the name Samaria also referred to the 10 tribes to the north. Beginning at the close of the 8th century, consummated in 722 B.C., the Assyrians carried them into bondage, settled them in the region between the Tigris River and between the Black Sea, south of the Caucasus Mountains, and the Caspian Sea, the area occupied by the Aryan Medes. They didn't stay settled long. They were made charioteers by Sargon's own testimony, and horsemen in the Assyrian army. And they were settled in that region between the Caspian Sea and the Tigris River and the Caucasus Mountains, Lake Van and the Black Sea, where the Medes were settled. Within a very short time after them being carried into bondage, the Assyrian Empire crumbles. Its territories divided by the rising Medes, the Aryans, and by the Chaldeans to the south. Nebuchadnezzar's empire begins to take shape. In the early period, the Medes are in the territory, and as Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom takes shape, the Judean southern kingdom is carried into bondage by Nebuchadnezzar for 70 years. They stay in bondage as Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom is replaced by the Medo-Persian combine, with the Persians becoming stronger than the Medes. For some reason, the Medes being the weaker and the Persians to the south dominating the kingdom. In that unrest at the breakdown of the Assyrian kingdom, and as the Medes were moving into the vacuum and the beginning formation of the Medo-Persian Empire is taking place, and Nebuchadnezzar is cementing his kingdom to the south on the Euphrates, Darius the Mede, in a later inscription, refers to a revolt of these Israelites. Esdras refers in his apocryphal book to these people being settled in the territory between the Tigris and the Caspian Sea, and offering the chance for them to return to their homeland under the Nebuchadnezzar Babylonian rule. They choose not to. Josephus references their dwelling place, and Esdras says they chose to pass out. Literally, he describes a geographic area that is the Caucasus Mountains through a gate or a narrow pass in the headwaters of the Euphrates River and pass to the regions beyond, taking a year and a half to make the journey through the headwaters of the Euphrates River. Subsequently, in the minds of most of the Christian world, to be lost. As the Scripture says, there have been hunters and fishers sent after them because they've been sought down through the centuries. We've been pursuing the tracings of these tribes because God made promises to them that if they are lost, you cannot bluff your way and save God's face by saying that the promises to Ephraim and to Joseph and to the kingdom of Israel have been fulfilled in Judah, because they haven't. God knows the difference. And in the last days, God will find them, and in Ezekiel they are named as being placed on two sticks, characterized as a valley of dry bones, and they come to life, and the two kingdoms are joined again as one kingdom with Christ their king, and God must find those tribes. And when the division of the land occurs in the millennial time seen by Ezekiel, the land is divided among the tribes. And during the tribulation days, in the book of Revelation, 12 tribes have seals placed in the forehead of 144,000 equally represented from each of 12 tribes. God hasn't forgotten them. Our purpose is to show God's faithfulness and to find the tracings. I leave the Khazarites where they were, but I want to talk about genealogy for a moment. When this line of promise went into Egypt, who was a Jew? They didn't become Jews until the Judean kingdom took shape. And it is the kingdom of Israel joined with Syria fighting the kingdom of Judah in the Bible, where we first read the reference as the kingdom of Israel is fighting in league with Syria, not Assyria, but Syria, against the Judaic kingdom. These denizens are called Jews for the first time. Now, that means Abraham wasn't a Jew. He's the father of the Jews. Isaac wasn't a Jew. Jacob wasn't a Jew. Joseph wasn't a Jew. Ephraim wasn't a Jew. And Judah wasn't a Jew. He is dead before they ever called them Jews. Jews designated the citizens, and subsequently their descendants, and then subsequently widened even more than that, of the kingdom of Judah. Now, we're going to talk genealogy. Joseph, I did this once before. Joseph was only a half-brother to Judah. You understand that, don't you? Why don't we call Joseph's kid Ephraim the Ephraimites? Why don't we call them Egyptians? Huh? Don't they have just as much right to be called Egyptians racially as descendants of Abraham? Huh? Don't they have just as much right to be called Egyptians as Israelites? They have just as much Egyptian blood in them as Israelite blood. They're right or wrong? There was some other funny lineage also in this 46th chapter of Genesis. When they went down into Egypt's bondage to fulfill the prophecy given to Abraham that would prove that the land belonged to him, it wasn't a pure, incestuous, Abrahamic race. 70 people went down. 2.25 million 400 years later. Boy, they're a prolific bunch. And they always have been. 2.25 million. You don't have to read the way these Old Testament characters play around to know why they have so many kids. I mean, they outdistance everybody they come in contact with. 70 of them went down to Egypt. 2.25 million in 4 generations. Just think for a minute and ask yourself, if any of you trace your family tree back to granddad, great-granddad, wait a minute, dad, granddad, great-granddad, great-great-granddad. That's as far as you got to go in your tree. How many of you think you've got 2.5 million fellow descendants from that great-great-granddad? Great-great, let me see, dad, granddad, great-granddad, great-great-granddad. You only have to go back to your great-great-granddad. And you got 2.25 million fellow descendants from your great-great-granddad? They ought to cast him in bronze and put him in the Smithsonian. I mean, they get on fast. Sing. Joseph was only a half brother to Judah. Right? That means Ephraim was what percentage related to Judah? How many of you know who or whom Ephraim married? I mean, he married a daughter of Judah? I mean, the bloodline sort of gets split rather quickly, doesn't it? When great-granddad gets going and you got 2.25 million, but now, or great-great-granddad, let's don't. Let's look at who went down to Egypt. That's the 46th chapter of Genesis. Verse 8. These are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt. Jacob and his sons Reuben, Jacob's firstborn. And the sons of Reuben, Hanok and Phallu and Hezron and Carmi. And the sons of Simeon, Jemuel and Jamin, and Ohad, and Jachin, and Zohar, and Sheul, the son of a Canaanitish woman. He fooled around again, didn't he? Now, those descendants of Sheul, they're at the rate of a great-great-great-granddad. That means we got some Canaanitish blood flowing now into that 2.25 million. How many of those 2.25 million, 4 generations later, are descendants of Sheol? Now, I need to sort of soften the blow on old Jacob, because the 2.25 million didn't really spring from him. It sprang from 70 of them. But it's still a right smart bunch of people. The sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And the sons of Judah, here we are, Judah. And Onan, and Shelah, and Pharez, and Zerah. Now, is that Zerah the same as Zara? Don't jump too quick, folks. That's answerable. If it is, I have question one. If it isn't, I have question two. In reverse, if it isn't, Zara, where's Zara? Where's Zara? Does that mean Zara didn't go down to Egypt? And if it is Zara, how come only Pharaoh's kids are named and Zara's aren't? Pharaoh's and Zerah, but and Onan died in the land of Canaan, so wipe them out. They didn't contribute to the 2.25 million. And the sons of Pharaoh's were Hezron and Hamul. Where's Zerah's kids if it's the same as Zara? And if it isn't, how come Zerah got no kids? Because he didn't have any yet. Is that Zara? And the sons of Issachar, Tola and Phuba. Boy, that's a name for you. He ought to be attorney general, Phuba. I could do something with that. And Job and Shimron. And the sons of Zebulun, Sered, and Elon, and Jaleel. These be the sons of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, and Padanaram with his daughter Dinah. All the souls of his sons and his daughters were 30 and 3. And the sons of Gad, and they're named. And the sons of Asher, and they're named. These are the sons of Zilpah, verse 18 says, whom Laban gave to Leah his daughter, and these she bare unto Jacob, even 16 souls. Now we've got another heathen. That's Leah's handmaiden. He's an active old man, this guy Jacob. Introduce some more foreign blood. Now, Zilpah's kids are part of that 2.25 million. Got it mixed up some more, haven't we? That's why I keep taking on this book by Pat Brooks, Hear, O Israel, who decides because that she has found, in her view, that more of the modern-day Jews, as she would call them, don't have pure Judaic blood. They're not really Jews. Well, they're already mixed up before the Jews ever got called Jews. That's the point I'm making. I mean, I'd hate to take blood types and figure out of the 2.25 million, how many are pure Abram? Zilpah. These are the sons of Zilpah whom Laban gave to Leah his daughter, and these she bare unto Jacob. Even she had 16. The sons of Rachel, Jacob's wife, Joseph and Benjamin. And unto Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, which Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bare unto him. Half Egyptians. Now, how many of the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh were in the 2.25 million? They're half Egyptians before they start. And do you know who they married? You don't know much about the gossip of the Middle East. Of Genesis, do you? And the sons of Benjamin were Bela and Becher, and Ashbel, Jera, and Naaman, Ehi, and Rosh, Mupim, and Huppim, and Ard. You think you have trouble naming kids? These are the sons of Rachel which were born to Jacob. All the souls were 14. And the sons of Dan, sort of ironic, hush them. Hush them up. And the sons of Naphtali, Jaziel, and Gunai, and Jezer, and Shillem. These are the sons of Bilhah, which Laban gave unto Rachel his daughter, and she bare these unto Jacob. Another handmaiden heathen. Got some more mixed blood. Terry said, wow. You, some of you women think it's tough being married to a deacon. You ought to be married to a patriarch. And all the souls that came with Jacob into Egypt, which came out of his loins, besides Jacob's sons' wives. All the souls, God gives the wives a little bit of credit there. I like the irony of that verse. All the souls that came with Jacob into Egypt, which came out of his loins, besides Jacob's sons' wives, who helped out a little. All the souls were 66. And the sons of Joseph, which were born him in Egypt, were 2 souls. All the souls of the house of Jacob, which came into Egypt, were 60 and 10. Simple point I'm making it right here. And I left Kira. Zera. We got to figure out if that Zera is the same as the other Zara. We will. But the point I make now, it wasn't a guaranteed pure Abraham blood crowd, that 2.25 million, when they left before they were ever called Jews. You buy that or not? Huh? You know, it's a shoe that fits different ways, but one of the damnable curses that will rest as a scar on this American nation throughout its entire days is the way the laws were written and the philosophy of the Old South that judged a Negro and made them qualify as a slave if they had 1/100th of 1/1000th of 1% traceable Negro blood. You know, it's an arbitrary determination. You got mixed blood, you're going to choose one and say if you got a drop of that in you, that qualifies you. And the law given in Exodus told these Jews if a stranger came in their midst, accepted their Torah, their law, circumcised him as the covenant relationship, and there would be one law for that stranger and one law for the non-stranger. They became Jews by the covenant. It's time you understand it is not as much a racial trait as it is a covenant trait. But where the promise relates to race, the smallest drop enables God to claim that as his child. The illegitimate sons, as well as the legitimate sons, adopted by the father, are treated as one of the chosen race. Now, there are extremists that become anti-Semitic that challenge the right of the Jewish nation to accept people who have come into their covenant faith if they think by some distortion of history they can find that there's any blood in them other than pure Abraham. Long before God ever settled them in the promised land, God was calling them his children. If they accepted his covenant, that's the more important criteria. And if their blood had the smallest portion, they qualified as an inheritor of the race. He would not call them his children if they lived out of a covenant relationship. He would call some that had none of the Abrahamic blood in them, who accepted his covenant relationship and met his terms. But if they had the trace of genealogical blood in them and also accepted his covenant, they qualified. You weren't an Egyptian because you were half Egyptian and half Jew. You were a Jew if you were in the covenant stream, if you were but 1/4, 1/10, 1/5, as you were of the kingdom of Israel likewise. I just want to lay that down on you so you understand. The genealogy tables alone do not determine the chosen race. But God made promises that are determined by genealogical tables. He said of the seed of David, there would be a throne for them. Now he's not talking about a theological covenant, an adoption of a faith. He's talking about a genealogical line that he can trace, old-fashioned though it may be. And where the promise is to genealogical tracings, he will keep that promise, but he's not bound to have 110% of the same blood in. The smallest tracing is sufficient as a thread that he can follow. You understand that? Where the promise is genealogical, he'll keep it genealogically. Where the promise is covenant, he will keep it to both the adopted sons and those by right of natural tracings. So these bigots that think by their own genealogical tracings they've figured out who doesn't have a right to be called O Israel, better quit crowding into God's territory who accepted strangers long ago and grafted them into the tree of his promise. And as Paul says, and he's right on point to this kind of arrogance in the Roman letter, if God could take a wild olive branch that never had a single iota of sap flowing through it from the native stock and graft the wild olive branch on, which is what the children of faith, the church, represents, and make them the recipients of Abraham's blessings, how much easier will it be for him to take the old natural stock and graft it right back on again where some affinity exists? So don't get too prideful in the blessings of the church and think that because that you have been grafted on and are receiving these blessings, don't forget, as he cut the old stock off, he can graft it back on again, and he will, because he's never forgotten about them. He knows right where they are. Now, what about this? Is this Zerah or Zerah? We'll come back to that. Okay, let's leave Zerah for a few minutes, and let's leave the Khazars, and I wanted to get to something else. But I just thought I'd get on something else for a few minutes. Remember I asked you, what did Plato say about Atlantis? You tired? You okay? You know, the modern theory that gained some vogue in recent years of the flotation theory of planets, that they are drifting. You heard that? That the planets are drifting. And the theory is that they were at one time possibly joined and have drifted over the centuries and the eons of time. Here's an interesting little book that just points out a fact. Like most of these theories that are heralded, they got holes in them. You undrift them and put them on any globe, cut it up yourself, just like an orange, and you're going to find something real interesting. As wonderful as the theory is, and it's amazing how many modern scientists accept that fact, that the continents are sort of drifting and that the crust of the earth is not as solid as people think it is. There's an interesting fact. When you join them, they only fit in South America and Africa. They don't fit up here. The shelves in the North Atlantic region just can't match up. You see that? See what I'm saying? You go get your own map and try to drift them back together, undrift them. I'm going to show you a map. Again, don't anybody conclude too soon on Scott. You're going to get yourself in a hole. Here's an ancient map. Sebastian Munster, 1540, identified the Insula Atlantica with the recently discovered South American continent. And these ancient medieval maps, several of them, had a big island between Europe and North America, much like this little center island would show. I'm just going to read to you about Plato. Can I do this? If I can find it for a minute. Of course, you can leave if you don't want to stick around. And old Alfred Wegener, in his theory of continental drift, has got a big hole up there in the Atlantic that just won't fit. Really, too bad, too. Go away. Oh, let's go home. I mean, you don't want to wait till I find this? When we speak of the Atlantic Ocean, how many of you know where it gets its name? Have you ever puzzled where we get the name? of the Atlantic Ocean. You call the Baltic Sea, you know where you get its name. Off of the Baltic Peninsula. Aegean Sea. Indian Ocean. Well, where do we get Atlantic? Why in the world is that ocean called Atlantic? Don't you know also that's where Atlas was supposed to have held the whole world up, held the heavens up, rather? You want to know what Plato said? He was talking to a traveler from Egypt. And this traveler, Solon, told him what he had heard down in Egypt about a mythical island out beyond the gates of Hercules, which means past the Rock of Gibraltar. And what he had learned in Egypt about what went on in this marvelous, wonderful island that was out there in the Atlantic Ocean. And what happened to it? And he has the most amazing description. Now, Plato's a respected philosopher. And he has the most amazing description of what happened to this island in one terrible day and one terrible night. You want me to read him? Sing me that song. Well, I'm going to quit teasing you now, because here it is, Plato's story of Atlantis, right on the first page. What we know about Atlantis is contained in the two famous dialogues by Plato, named after the Pythagorean Timaeus and Plato's maternal uncle, Critias the Younger. They are a direct continuation of Plato's 10 political volumes, The Republic. Atlantis is described as an historical fact, as a state that really existed and was clearly defined in time and place. A perfect example of the postulates laid down by Plato's teacher Socrates for the ideal state. Discussions on the subject had taken place among Socrates, Glaucus, Adeimantus, and others during a festival celebrated at Piraeus in honor of the Thracian goddess Bendis. They had continued on the following day among Socrates, Critias the Younger, Timaeus, Hermocrates, and an unnamed fourth person, presumably Plato himself. In the course of these conversations, Critias told a story, strange but perfectly true, as the wise Solon, who had brought it from Egypt to Greece, had claimed it was. It was a story of an ancient, glorious state, which the Greeks of Plato's time had long forgotten. But an aged priest of Sais, a large city in the Nile Delta, had strange tales to relate of it. He began by saying that the Greeks were all like children, for they had no ancient knowledge based on many years of tradition or any lore hallowed by time. This was his story. The cause is as follows. Much destruction has befallen mankind in varying ways, and it will continue in the future. Now remember, I asked a question about the pyramids. I said, who built it? Did Enoch build it? He was a preacher of righteousness before the flood. Did he possibly, knowing the destruction was going to come when his own kid died? That's what made him live very righteous. And he was the lone preacher of righteousness. Did he, over those 300 and some years, decide to preserve the message of God's purposes somewhere? Did Noah build it? You know, you can do a lot of things if you live as long as those guys did, besides produce kids. Ham build it? Trying to overcompensate for his curse? Remember I made a passing reference to worlds and collisions? Or worlds and collision, the scientist that has pointed out that all scientific theories of time are based upon a simple premise of faith that cannot be proven. That everything has always gone on at the same rate of time, the same way. Mountains weathering down to plains. Upheavals that make little mountains that weather down to plains. Limestone strata raised upward by upheavals. Waters washing them down to plains. But there is evidence that things didn't always happen at the same rate. You dig up a mammoth in Siberia. Some cataclysm hit it so fast, froze it solid that the dogs can eat the flesh when they uncover it, and in the stomach and in the teeth of the mammoth. Food undigested in the stomach and in the mouth of the mammoth that only grows in tropical areas. Something happened awful fast. Has it ever puzzled you if the flood occupied only 40 days? Has it ever puzzled you if it's simply a rainstorm that a few geese and ducks didn't live through it? They can fly and swim, you know. And Noah didn't take an aquarium on his boat. That was all around him. He didn't take two whales and two sharks and two minnows and two perch and two eels. Now, hasn't it ever occurred to you to ask, how come the waterfowl didn't just survive a good hard rainstorm and gorge themselves on the fish in the water? It had to be more. It talks about the fissures of the deep opening up. It had to be something so catastrophic that the birds that fly were wiped out too. You know, I think about these things. I don't think you have to be a bonehead to be a Christian. Now, me and God, we wrestle about a lot of things. Took him a few years to get my head to realize he was smart enough. I'd give him some time. He'd lead me down the path, and I'd figure out he knew what was happening all along. I was reading Plato. This was his story. The cause is as follows. Much destruction has befallen mankind in varying ways, and it will continue in the future. The greatest disasters by fire and water, and the lesser by a thousand other causes. Now, Plato is as respected as any ancient. He wasn't in the habit of confusing his listeners. He knew the difference between form and substance, and when he was talking in riddle and parable, he made that clear. If he talked as though something were a fact, and it wasn't a fact, then it's the only hoax he perpetrated on all of his students. With a record 10 volumes long of veracity in statements. The tradition you share with others, according to which Phaethon, the son of Helios, having put the horses to his father's chariot but unable to keep in his father's track, scorched everything on earth and was himself struck dead by lightning, is passed on as something that sounds like a fable. You can go sit down. You may want to take notes. But the truth it contains is the deviation from their courses. It's passed on like a fable. This learned traveler from Egypt is saying, and in essence he's saying, distinguish between fable and fact. He says, this tradition you share with others, according to which Phaethon, the son of Helios, having put the horses to his father's chariot, but unable to keep in his father's track, scorched everything on earth and was himself struck dead by lightning, is passed on as something that sounds like a fable. Now, here are these old philosophers sitting around, four of them, having a conversation. One of them is saying, you Greeks have no real tradition and no history, and you go around sort of with blinders on. Let me point out to you, you've got some traditions you've assimilated you haven't even thought about. Now, this tradition sounds like a fable, but this is what the fable contains. And here in Plato's day are these philosophers recognizing the distinction between the fables and the truths they carried. As is the case in Ireland, where they had no written history for years, and they passed them on by word of mouth until what became legends contained truth underneath. Don't you know, he says, that the truth it contains is the deviation from their courses of the stars in the heavens that revolve around the earth, and after long periods of time, the destruction by much fire of everything on earth. Naturally, the inhabitants of mountains and dry uplands perish in greater number than those living on the banks of rivers and by the sea. To us, however, the Nile is the Savior, as it is in all other things, for it bursts its banks and thus saves us from this disaster. But when the gods cleansing the earth with water sent a flood, those living on the mountains, the cowherds and shepherds, will be saved, but you town dwellers will be carried away to the sea by the rivers. You tell them, you need to build into your expectancy cataclysmic happenings that mark the history of this earth, and the legends we're talking about are but poetic ways of describing some real events. And he goes on. This is why the tradition preserved us and among us is considered the most ancient. In truth, we Egyptians, however the numbers of mankind increase, greatly or not so greatly, wherever there is no excessive heat or cold to prevent it. But all the beautiful, great, or significant events that take place among you or us, or anywhere else, will be recorded wholly and fully in our temples, as we receive word of them and will thus be preserved for posterity. The Egyptians had a tradition of saving things for posterity. That's what he's saying. But with you, you Greeks, and the others, everything has only recently been newly established again, through written documents and through everything that the state requires. Now remember this and hang it up there. I'm going to bring you one of the world's leading archaeologists who has spent his life proving that the Greeks and the Hebrews had a common root source. Just hang that up there for a while. I'll get back to it. After the usual number of years, the heavens open up on mankind again, and like an epidemic, sweep away all but the ignorant and the uneducated. And you will be, as it were, made young again, as at the beginning of time, for you'll know nothing of what happened here nor what happened to your ancestors in ancient times. What he's saying is, you dummies, because you keep no record, there'll be another upheaval come, and you'll be as innocent as if nothing ever happened before you that survived came on the scene. You need a space capsule to write it down. Pretty smart old Egyptian. At least what you, old Solon, have just said about the generation in your country sounds almost like a fairy tale. First, you remember only one deluge on earth, although many occurred before. You don't know how many times this earth's been flooded, do you? We just know that when God flooded it in Noah's day, he put a covenant rainbow in the sky and said, I'll never do it again. But I've preached for years, Genesis 1, 2 onward is recreation. And as he begins to recreate, it follows him hovering over the face of the deep. First, you remember only one deluge on earth, although many occurred before. Nor do you know, because a long time ago only a small tribe survived, that the best and most beautiful race of men lived in your country, the race from which you and your nation sprang. All this has been hidden from you and remained hidden from you, because for many generations the survivors have lived without leaving any written records behind. Boy, he's really chewing them out, isn't he? Knocking the Greek's pride down the tube. Once upon a time, O Solon, before it was utterly destroyed by water, the state now inhabited by the Athenians boasted the most excellent laws for its army as well as for every other institution. How do you know where all those people prior to the flood were circulating, who lived hundreds and hundreds of years to compound their wisdom? Once upon a time, the state now inhabited by the Athenians boasted the most excellent laws for its army as well as for every other institution. It was also said to have performed the most valiant deeds and enjoyed the wisest constitution of all that have come to our knowledge. You therefore lived under the protection of such laws as well as of an excellent administration and surpassed all other nations in every skill as befits the children and wards of the gods. Many of your great deeds that have been recorded here or admired. One, however, stands out from all the others through its greatness and excellence. For the records mention the great power that your state once vanquished, a power that came from the Atlantic Ocean beyond and that invaded in its arrogance the whole of Europe and Asia. For the sea there was navigable at the time. Now, if you're going to listen to Plato, I mean, I had Plato crammed down my neck like he was God Almighty when I was in graduate school at Stanford. And then they belittle Matthew, Mark, and Luke because they record a miracle that Christ performed, the devil being cast out. Well, here's Plato for you. If he's so accurate, as the philosophers say, try this one on for size. Your records, he says to those dumb Greeks, mention the great power that your state once vanquished. They leave out this greatest deed you did. A power that came from the Atlantic Ocean beyond and that invaded in its arrogance the whole of Europe and Asia. Hey, this ain't no science fiction writer. This is Plato. You got that? For the sea there was navigable at the time. There was beyond the strait you call the Pillars of Hercules an island larger than Asia and Libya together. Now Asia to him in those days, and it can be proven on the maps of those days, was the Aegean Peninsula. So take Libya that they knew because they traded with Libya, and the Aegean Peninsula, put them together, and that's the size, he says, this island is, larger than Asia and Libya together, from where it was still possible then. Now, the dumb nuts of the Middle Ages sunk so low in ignorance, and the libraries were burned by stupid Catholics and stupid Arabs, until much of this was lost until the Enlightenment. But here in 1492, they think the world's flat and Columbus is going to sail off the other end, drop off. But here in Plato's day, they talk of an inhabited island beyond the gates of Hercules, beyond Gibraltar, about the combined size of the Aegean Peninsula and Libya, and from whence on the other side of that island, it was still possible then to sail to the other islands. Now, if such an island existed just outside the gates of Hercules, just outside the Straits of Gibraltar, what's on the other side? You're going to come to the islands of the West Indies, You're going to come to the islands that dot the Caribbean, from Bermuda down through the Bermuda Triangle to the West Indies. I was going to show you a map. Well, here it is. If such an island existed, I showed you this before. Here is a guy in Plato's day saying that once you get there, from there it's possible to sail, and you're in Gulf Stream waters, from there to sail to the islands to the west. A much easier task than trying to set out and sail the whole trip. You understand? This is Plato still. From which it was still possible then to sail to the other islands, and thence to the whole continent on the other side. They had a pretty good viewpoint and understanding of geography. Lost to the Middle Ages. Somebody called earlier and said to me, they just found evidence he read in a Harvard magazine of Phoenicians in the United States or in the Americas in 1000 B.C. Do you know about that? Yes, they got there sooner than that. To the whole continent on the other side, which encloses the sea, truly named after it. There's where you get your name, Atlantic. For everything that is situated on this side of the strait of which we're talking appears like a bay with a narrow entrance, that the sea may properly be called an ocean and the land enclosing it is properly a continent. On this island of Atlantis, there existed a great and admirable kingdom, which had taken possession of the entire island as well as of the other islands and of parts of that continent. They still haven't figured out how these advanced civilizations in North and South America originated. On this island of Atlantis, there existed a great and admirable kingdom which had taken possession of the entire island as well as the other islands and of parts of that continent. In addition to the land situated this side of the strait, it ruled over Libya as far as the borders of Egypt and over Europe as far as Tyrrhenia. But the Grecians defeat them. That's what he's telling them. This mighty power once tried to subdue both your country, Greece, and ours, Egypt, and everything situated within the strait in a single attack. At that time, old Solon, the power of your state became clear to all, shining in valor and achievement. For the Greeks were the leaders of all the countries, and surpassed them all in courage and fighting skill. And when the others defected, they were thrown back on themselves alone and were exposed to the greatest danger. But they beat the enemy and celebrated a victory. And they also saved those not yet subdued from defeat and generously restored the freedom of all. This is direct translation from Plato. And generously restored the freedom of all the others that lived within the pillars of Hercules. But later, when there came violent earthquakes and floods, the entire valiant generation of your people was swallowed up by the earth. And the island of Atlantis was similarly swallowed by the sea and vanished in a single dreadful day and in a single dreadful night. That is why the sea is no longer navigable there and cannot be crossed in ships, because this is prevented by the very deep mud that remains of the island when it sank. How many of you know what lies beneath the Azores Islands? We'll come back to that. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Now they're going to box me up again. Because people have looked for Atlantis for centuries. All I got to say is don't get on to me for believing Matthew, Mark, and Luke about a few demons being cast out and Paul about Jesus raising from the dead if you're going to follow after Plato with that story. I had a college kid come up to me and was preaching on Revelation. He said in the bookstore after paunching around for a while and getting the nerve, "You believe the things you preach on TV? Hey, you philosophers believe Plato?" Kind of a wild story, isn't it? I wonder where those eels used to go. I mean, when they were breeding, if Plato's right, when they were breeding in the Sargasso Sea, they didn't have as long a swim. Just go to Atlantis. All of a sudden, they make the swim the next year. And no Atlantis. You've got to keep going all the way to Europe. We got to come back to that. Now, oh my Lord, it's 11:30. And I was just getting started. I got to quit. Now, let me see. We got eels swimming. An island just blown up, if Plato's right. The Khazars that are Jews and not Jews, by some people's imagination. The 10 tribes lost but not lost. The tribe of Dan in Ireland that's legend and not legend. That's only part of what we got. And Zerah. And whether Zerah's Zera. And why Zerah's dangling. Thank God we got a fountain of faith piercing the globe. We'll be here till Jesus comes. Give me the song, "I Feel Good." Or whatever you got. I want you to talk to me. I want to see if I put you to sleep.